This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January the 19th, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the Chinese president responds to questions about human rights. An American teen enters his fifth week in a Kuwaiti detention center. US officials refuse to let him back in the US. And demonstrators in Mexico decry the recent murders of two women activists in Ciudad Juarez. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with News Briefs for FSRN. Federal regulators met with the families of the victims of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia last night. They blamed the explosion that left 29 people dead on faulty equipment. According to NPR, several attendees said they were told by officials that if the mine had met federal safety standards, the explosion would not have happened. The full report will be released within 90 days. Massey Energy, the owner of the mine, is scheduled to issue its own investigation results on Friday. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear an appeal of the Washington, D.C. law legalizing same-sex marriage. This likely exhausts all legal avenues aimed at overturning the law. Opponents have indicated they will seek intervention by the U.S. Congress. In South Sudan, preliminary results from the independence referendum indicate passage by a large margin. Reuters reports that in the southern capital of Juba, about 99% voted in favor of independence from the north. Head EU observer Veronique de Keyser.
The headlines of our preliminary statement is a peaceful, credible voting process with overwhelming turnout mark Southern Sudan referendum.
Audio from Voice of America. Final results are expected by mid-February. Several Arab nations have introduced a resolution to the UN Security Council saying continued Israeli settlement construction is hampering the peace process. This comes after Israel announced plans last weekend to build 1,400 apartments in East Jerusalem. In Gaza, a fresh agreement between Hamas and smaller armed resistance factions to halt homemade rocket fire into Israel is in jeopardy. After an unknown group launched a rocket into Israel earlier this week, an Israeli tank killed a Palestinian along the border. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Border skirmishes between Israeli military forces and Palestinian factions in Gaza have become the norm over the last 6 months. This has increased fears that another large-scale Israeli military attack on Gaza could happen at any time. In an effort to ease tensions, Hamas recently came to an agreement with Gaza-based armed factions on a unilateral ceasefire with Israel. But the agreement is not holding. Mohamed Abu Sada is a Gaza-based political analyst. He says continued homemade rocket from Gaza is an embarrassment to Hamas.
It seems to me that Hamas will have to do much better than what it has done over the past few weeks to try to reinforce the ceasefire and basically to try to convince all these Palestinian factions that it's in the interest of the Palestinians and not to give Israel the excuse to launch any attacks on the Gaza Strip.
Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
The new Tunisian government has released all political prisoners. The new regional development minister of the coalition government told Reuters this includes members of an Islamist group banned in the country. More than 100 people have been killed in protests over the past month, at least 70 shot by Tunisian security forces. And that's News Briefs for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Chinese President Hu Jintao met with Obama administration officials today, part of a four-day visit to the U.S. that includes a state dinner. During a press briefing, President Obama announced the two countries are expanding trade, including $45 billion in export deals that could create more than 230,000 U.S. jobs. Obama said the two countries are working on a renewable energy project and to reduce greenhouse gases. And they discussed human rights.
Today, we've agreed to move ahead with our formal dialogue on human rights. We've agreed to new exchanges to advance the rule of law. And even as we, the United States, recognize that Tibet is part of the People's Republic of China, the United States continues to support further dialogue between the government of China and the representatives of the Dalai Lama to resolve concerns and differences, including the preservation of the religious and cultural identity of the Tibetan people.
Human rights groups want Western officials to take a stronger stance against abuses, like China's high number of executions and the detention and imprisonment of dissidents. Speaking through a translator, President Hu said each of the 8 times he's spoken with the US president, they've discussed human rights.
China is always committed to the protection and promotion of human rights. And in the course of human rights, China has also made enormous progress recognized widely in the world. China recognizes and also respects the universality of human rights. And at the same time, we do believe that we also need to take into account the different national circumstances when it comes to the universal value of human rights. China is a developing country with a huge population and also a developing country in a crucial stage of reform. In this context, China still faces many challenges in economic and social development, and a lot still needs to be done in China in terms of human rights.
Presidents Hu and Obama both described their human rights conversations as candid, but Obama did say that despite differences, engagement can continue in other areas. Hu is meeting with Republican and Democratic lawmakers on Thursday and then flies to Chicago to meet with business representatives. Lawyers for an American teenager detained in Kuwait continue to press for his safe return to the United States. Gulet Muhammad has now been in custody for a month, and his relatives and lawyers say he's been beaten by Kuwaiti authorities and interrogated by the FBI. He tried to fly home this week, but US officials have his name on a no-fly list. A hearing on Thursday in a district court in Virginia could decide his fate. Ghadir Abbas is a staff attorney with the Council on American-Islamic Relations and represents Muhammad. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you filed a lawsuit against the US government in an attempt to help your client return home. What are you charging?
My client is an American citizen, and he has the absolute right to return and reside within the United States. And the government is depriving him of that absolute and fundamental right. So it's a very straightforward and simple legal action. My client, Gulet, has those rights, and the government is violating those rights. And yesterday, when we filed our lawsuit, we heard back from the judge within an hour, and a hearing was scheduled later that afternoon. So, we filed, and 4 hours later, we were in a courtroom before the judge with attorneys for the government. And the judge agreed that the government actions are presents a clear violation of Gulet's rights. And so he scheduled another hearing on Thursday based on the government's representations that they are currently doing something to return him to the U.S. Now, we're, dubious of those promises because in the past, Gulet has been visited once by a consulate official when he first turned up in a deportation facility, and he was told that he was going to leave in 72 hours. So this time the government is telling us that he's going to leave in 48 hours. So, we are optimistic and we're hopeful, but, we're also realistic.
So what exactly is going to happen at this hearing on Thursday? Sounds like from what you're saying, you don't really expect very much.
Well, it can go, one of several ways. I think the judge has made very clear that he's inclined to order the government to take Gulet off of the no-fly list and allow him to return to the U.S. So, I think in the hearing yesterday, the judge made that very clear to the government and told us what we needed to do on Thursday to allow him to issue an order. So, you know, our hope is that, you know, before Thursday, sometime later today or before the hearing tomorrow, that the government has put Goulet on a plane back to the U.S. But, you know, I spoke with Goulet's family today, who in turn has spoken with Goulet, and he has not received any contact or information from any American official. I haven't, neither has my co-counsel Nadira Khalili or any member of the family. So if the government isn't willing to do the right thing, I think the judge will make them.
Have government officials told you why Muhammad is on the no-fly list?
No. It's one of the side tragedies in this case is that the U.S. government just feels that it's okay to not comment at all on a case alleging deprivations of, you know, the First Order. So, you know, that's been very frustrating and upsetting. We've contacted the White House. We've contacted the Department of Justice, the FBI. We've made inquiries to the embassy, the State Department. And, you know, we get cursory responses. We'll look into it. We'll get back to you immediately. But, you know, we have nothing to show for it, and no inkling of evidence that the government is doing something.
Now, Goulet Muhammad was first detained on December the 20th after a routine visit to renew his visa. He was then held at an undisclosed location, and he says he was tortured. What's he told you about these events, and do you have any evidence U.S. authorities knew about this or facilitated his detention?
Yeah, you know, we do have some evidence that the U.S. government facilitated or might have even directed his detention. The first piece of evidence that we have are just the types of questions that he was asked. His interrogators, who spoke both English and Arabic, and Goulet was unable to determine of what descent they were because he was blindfolded. During those interrogations, he was asked very specific questions about his, you know, family, his siblings, different happenings in Northern Virginia. That it's, you know, it's highly implausible that you know the Kuwaiti intelligence apparatus had, you know, could access that information and acquire it independently of the U.S. government. The second thing is Goulet's treatment after he was transferred to the deportation facility. Once he got to the deportation facility, it's, you know, highly unfortunate but and absurd as well that Kuwaiti officials were his strongest state advocates for his return to the U.S. They've reached out to the embassy themselves and haven't heard back. And on this past Sunday, they actually just tried to do an end run around the no-fly list, directed the family to purchase a ticket, and just took Goulet to the airport and tried to force him onto the plane, but they couldn't. And those are the two, you know, concrete, you know, pieces of information that we have that suggest that suggest American involvement in his detention and torture. And the third is contextual. Kuwait is a very, very small country that is, very dependent on the U.S. for security, et cetera. So, you know, we think it's just on the face of it, it's that it's unlikely that Kuwait would take it upon itself to torture an American citizen without at least the acquiescence of the United States government.
Ghadir Abbas, staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
FSRN has experienced some trying times recently. Funding shortfalls nearly took us off the air. But because of you, our listeners, FSRN has survived. Your generous donations have saved this newscast from the brink. Thanks. But the fight is not over. FSRN staff will continue to offer scaled-back programming through January while we develop our long-term sustainable strategy. That's where you come in. Please help our sustainability fund by visiting fsrn.org. Today, House members once again debated healthcare reform as Republicans like Trey Gowdy of South Carolina pushed for repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
The Constitution of the United States has limits, and surely one of those limits must be that Congress cannot compel a private citizen to engage in a private commercial transaction.
Democrats pushed back, arguing that Republicans are not being honest about the impact of the repeal. Virginia Representative Bobby Scott.
We need to talk about what's going to happen to those under 26 that are now able to stay on their parents' policies. Repeal will kick them off of those policies. We need to talk about what's going to happen to those with pre-existing conditions. We need to talk about what's happening to those who can now get checkups and annual checkups and preventive care with no copays and deductibles.
Republican John Tierney of Massachusetts called the Republican-led repeal effort fruitless.
Instead of working together and building on the work that's been done and the progress that's been made, we find ourselves here today debating and voting on a bill which, while it may pass the House, most certainly will never become law, and nor should it.
Research released today by the progressive group People for the American Way shows the impact of the Citizens United ruling on the repeal effort. The group found that industry opponents of healthcare reform contributed more than $100 million in the 36 November congressional races, where House members who voted for the bill lost their seats. In a 4-1 vote, the Federal Communications Commission approved internet and cable provider Comcast's acquisition of NBC Universal. Some media diversity groups oppose the acquisition, saying it will lead to more media concentration. Critics also say the deal will decrease competition and drive up costs. For more, we go to Andy J. Schwartzman, Policy Director of Media Access Project. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi.
You say this decision will be devastating for freedom of speech. Why?
Well, it allows the largest cable operator to have a tremendous hold on access to content, and the combination will allow it to leverage control over whether new online video services can come on the air and whether independent video programmers will be able to get suitable access on cable systems, not just Comcast cable systems, but all cable systems.
What are the main reasons then the FCC gave its approval?
Well, in fairness, the FCC acknowledged the kinds of problems that we pointed out, and they did take steps, in some cases adequate steps, to address some of the things that we pointed out, but generally not enough to ameliorate the difficulties.
The deal was approved by a 4-1 vote, but Commissioner Michael J. Copps dissented. Why exactly did he dissent?
Well, he has an eloquent statement, which is that with all of the conditions added, it helped, but it's not enough, that the degree of power being given to one company, particularly in the new internet space and also in the broadcast field, simply cannot be adequately addressed.
Now, in December, the NAACP and other civil rights groups endorsed the merger after Comcast and NBC Universal promised to increase diversity. Under this agreement, the FCC also said that companies will, and I'm quoting here, enhance the diversity of programming available to Spanish-speaking viewers and offer broadband services to low-income communities. But some of the other diversity commitments are labeled as voluntary. What kind of mechanisms are in place to ensure the merged companies are offering increased diversity?
The full text of the order has yet to be released and won't be out for another day or two. In general, a couple of the civil rights groups that endorsed the deal were focusing on the broadcast provisions of the order. We think that what was done there was not enough, particularly with respect to Spanish language television, the Telemundo stations that NBC owns. But our concern extended to the online video and other programming spaces, because we think much of the future is there. So some of the reasons I think they went for it is their focus on the traditional media, whereas we are as concerned about the new media.
Can you just give an example of why this is going to make it difficult for an online content provider?
Well, Comcast has acquired a lot of channels like USA Network, Bravo, and so forth, and it's going to fill up the Comcast systems with those channels. So when a new cable programmer shows up, there's, first of all, fewer channels available for it to play on, and second, Comcast is in a more powerful position to require higher fees or more conditions, and that makes it harder and harder for new independent programmers to get the necessary distribution.
Another aspect of this decision, the FCC has approved measures that are designed to limit any damage to pay TV competitors, and they say to help nurture the emerging market for online video. What exactly are they?
Because Comcast is acquiring this package of Bravo and USA and these other channels, it can now say to satellite competitors like DirecTV and Dish, and to potentially new online video distributors, okay, we'll let you have the NBC network programming, we'll let you have the USA network programming, but also if you take our sci-fi channel and our brand new animal birthday channel, and they can force those additional channels on to companies like DirecTV and Dish TV. There are some arbitration provisions designed to assist the competing video providers, but there's not enough. For example, they can require this bundle to be made available rather than requiring them to, quote-unquote, break the bundle and offer these channels individually.
Andy J. Schwartzman, Senior Vice President and Policy Director of Media Access Project, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
My pleasure.
In Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, a 16-year-old girl was found dead yesterday with marks of sexual abuse. She's the latest victim in a long-running string of unsolved rape murders. The murder follows demonstrations last weekend to protest the climate of impunity surrounding hundreds of cases of murdered women. While these so-called femicides have been occurring in the state of Chihuahua since the mid-90s, what sparked this weekend's demonstrations were the recent murders of two women who were known for their activism on femicide cases. Shannon Young has more.
Activists held marches and vigils in at least five Mexican cities to call for justice in the cases of Marisela Escobedo, Susana Chavez, and hundreds of other women who have been murdered in Mexico. Before Ciudad Juarez gained the reputation as the murder capital of the world, it was infamous for its femicide cases. The rapes and murders of young women went unpunished in the border city across from El Paso, Texas, and spread to the state capital of Chihuahua City. For Norma Ledesma, whose 16-year-old daughter was killed in 2002, there's a reason the murders have not only continued, but increased.
La razón es de la impunidad.
The reason is impunity. Impunity is an invitation to repeat the same crime. The lack of justice is what's causing the continued murders of women and of men. History is showing us that in Chihuahua, we continue to have a large number of unsolved murders of women every year. The same killers that were loose 10 years ago could possibly be those who keep killing today. Why? Because there's no justice. And who's responsible? Those who are supposed to ensure that justice is served and haven't. In other words, the authorities.
In 2010, the state of Chihuahua registered a record-setting 446 cases of murdered women. Among them was Marisela Escobedo, who was shot in the back of the head outside of the government palace in Chihuahua City while protesting the lack of action in her murdered daughter's case.
Justicia, señores. Estos jueces...
Escobedo was calling for justice. After her daughter went missing, the retired nurse tracked down her son-in-law, who confessed to the killing and led police to the spot where he had dumped the remains. But a three-judge panel released him on a legal technicality. Marisela Escobedo successfully appealed the ruling and was calling on authorities to execute the arrest warrant when she was gunned down. Her murder sent a chill through the community of human rights activists in Mexico. 3 weeks later, Juarez-based activist and poet Susana Chavez was found dead with her left hand cut off.
Es un poema que escribió Susana Chávez hace varios años, que quedó antologado en Canto una ciudad en el desierto. Se llama Sangre mía.
Activists in Ciudad Juarez read poetry written by Susana Chavez in the spot where her body was discovered. Chihuahua State Police investigators say a group of teenagers killed Chavez in a drunken argument. Some people familiar with the city's femicide cases are skeptical of the official story. Others have accepted it. The murders of two women associated with the fight against impunity in Chihuahua's femicide cases has had an impact on other activists who have received threats. Again, Norma Ledesma of the association Justice for Our Daughters.
I can't look back and allow fear to paralyze me, but unfortunately, it does limit me. It keeps me from going out at night like I used to. It keeps me from speaking openly with local media like I used to. It limits me by making me sick with stress, but it doesn't paralyze me.
Ledesma says she spoke recently with the other mothers of the Justice for Our Daughters organization about the killings of anti-femicide activists. She said that if she too is killed, she wants the other mothers to step over her body and continue to seek justice for their murdered daughters. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
Journalist, author, and rabble-rouser John Ross died Monday of liver cancer. Ross spent decades covering indigenous rights and social justice issues in Mexico, often living for many years with the communities he covered. He wrote several books about the Zapatista movement, including Rebellion from the Roots, and won the Upton Sinclair and American Book Awards. Last year, he told Democracy Now! About what happened in the weeks following Mexico's devastating 8.1 magnitude earthquake in 1985, before he permanently took up residence in Mexico City.
I arrived 1 week after the earthquake on September 26th and settled into an old creepy hotel in the Centro Histórico, where I still live, and became part of a movement of earthquake victims, damnificados, that organized a movement from which the civil society resurged in Mexico, a very resurgent civil society. That movement evolved from the individual buildings. Each building was an organization unto itself. Each block was an organization. Each neighborhood was an organization. Within 3 weeks, we had put 100,000 people in front of the Mexican White House, Los Pinos. And with that pressure from down below, replacement housing, precisely where the housing had come down, 30,000 people were killed, over 10,000 buildings damaged, 1,000 came down. But replacement housing was built exactly where it had come down due to the pressure from down below. And that movement of damnificados, that movement of earthquake victims, very quickly translated into political terms.
Ross first visited Mexico in the 1950s with a group of beat poets. Over the years, he published his own work, and when he joined the Pacific News Service in the 80s, he took on the title Investigative Poet. In an obituary in The Nation, John Nichols described Ross as a speak truth to power reporter, who repeatedly risked his life to tell great stories and to demand that political and economic elites respond. Ross died Monday in Mexico City at the age of 72. That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Jess Burns. Our technical producer at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katabchi. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, Julie Alexander, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.